Chapter 14. Brock Steele closed his office door and stepped over to the panoramic windows that gave him a great view over downtown Los Angeles, and on days when the smog wasn't too bad, the Pacific Ocean. He pressed a button on his phone and put it to his ear. It was answered immediately.
Skippy the Magnificent? Skippy! It's Brock Steele is not here at the moment, but please leave a message after the beep and I'll get back to you. Maybe.
Brock stared at the phone, his face turning red.
Shit.
He kept waiting for a beep that never happened.
Hello?
Skippy laughed.
That joke works every time. Mr. Magnificent.
Brock silently shook a fist at the phone.
It is so good to hear from you again, he said, ignoring the fact that he had initiated the call.
Also, the fact that Valkyrie had jumped into orbit 2 days before, yet Skippy had not taken the time to call an old friend.
Hey, it's good to hear from you too, Brock. Jeez, sorry. I have been super busy up here.
I heard. You found a cache of elder weapons? That is incredible. You are even more magnificent than I imagined.
Well, you know, it's just a little thing I did. Really, it was Joe's idea.
Come on, Skippy, we both know that Joe sketches out the broad concepts and you make it all happen.
Oh, well, I...
Don't be so modest, Mr. Magnificent.
Well, I have heard that false modesty can be insulting to the audience.
Exactly. And I am all about respecting other people, as you know.
I know it very well, Brock lied.
Listen, Skippy, I know you are extremely busy, so I won't take up your valuable time. I just wanted to check in with you.
Are you okay?
Sure, why?
It's just... I heard what happened. About you temporarily stepping away from the pirates.
He avoided using words like abandoned or bailed. To fulfill your higher purpose.
Oh, well, the AI sputtered.
You heard about that, huh?
It was part of a classified briefing I received yesterday.
I am terribly sorry about that unfortunate incident.
You are?
Why are you sorry about it, Brock? You weren't there.
I am sorry on behalf of mankind that we failed you. The reason you felt the need to seek assistance from more advanced species is because we humans are unable to provide the support you need.
Geez, I guess you are right about that. I mean, I am also personally sorry that I was not there for you. During the briefing, I kept thinking that if I had been there instead of Bishop, you would not have...
Excuse me?
Instantly, Brock knew he had said the wrong thing.
What I meant is... Skippy's voice was icy.
I think we both know what you meant.
Why only? If you open your mouth again, you need to be very careful. Joe Bishop is my best friend. He is the finest human being, the finest being I have ever met.
The AI choked up.
I don't deserve him to have a friend like Joe. I failed him and he nearly died.
Brock Steele had not become a billionaire by being stupid. His opening strategy had been a spectacular failure. He knew it was time to try something else and fast.
I only meant that because of your respect for Bishop, you might have expected he could take care of the situation by himself, he lied smoothly.
If someone else had been there, you would have ensured they returned to the ship before you departed on your important mission. That would have given you time to reconsider.
Oh. I hadn't thought of that. At the time, I wasn't thinking clearly at all.
Or you were thinking, just on a level we poor monkeys can't understand.
Maybe.
Brock decided it was time to change the subject.
Mr. Magnificent, I heard that you suffered a tragic loss.
I did?
Yes.
Your Elvis belt and your dogs playing poker painting and all your other unique and tastefully selected valuables.
Ah, he sighed.
Yes, I did. It was an unavoidable yet tragic loss.
May I...
No. No, it's too little. Forget I mentioned it.
What?
Really, it is better for me not to mention it at all than to embarrass myself with a gesture that is unworthy of you.
What gesture?
Skippy, you saved the world. Again. It's kind of what I do, you know, so that is why I should not have mentioned it.
What? He pleaded.
If you insist.
I do.
On behalf of humanity, and I know this humble gesture is in no way worthy of your consideration, I would like to give you a very small token of our gratitude. Another original from the Dogs Playing Poker series.
Oh!
Skippy shuddered. And a jumpsuit that Elvis wore in concert during his Vegas shows in 1969.
Oh!
Plus, I know this is insulting, but I would like to give you a shirt worn by Elvis in the film Blue Hawaii. Skippy gasped.
I can't.
Really? I know it is a pathetic gesture, but I vow that we will do better.
No, this is great.
The debrief at Fort Carson was no worse than any I'd had before, and I won't get into a lot of the details. There were more people involved in the Q&A sessions because of UNEF politics. Each of the UNEF nations was allowed to have a representative in the main sessions, plus each member nation got a separate meeting with me if they wanted. Spoiler alert, every nation did insist on scheduling their own meeting with me, either because they genuinely had concerns or just for national prestige. Meeting with four other national teams of interrogators would have been tiring enough, but UNEF now had 12 member nations. America, China, Britain, France, and India were the permanent members. And now there were 7 associate members: Japan, Brazil, Indonesia, Australia, Chile, South Africa, and Egypt. There had been a debate about adding Russia as an associate member, now that their nasty internal political turmoil was settling down, but that wasn't happening anytime soon. Anyway, the U.S. Army provided a team to sit in with me during my meetings with foreign nations, and I was calm and polite and answered everyone's questions as best I could. Really, it wasn't difficult, just repetitive and tedious. No one had new questions to ask. Everything important had been thoroughly covered in the first session. That meeting was me sitting at a table facing tables with 36 military and government officials, 3 from each UNEF nation. The most critical question came from a guy from the Chinese Navy. He interrupted me while I was recounting how I ordered the Maxulks to leave our solar system.
Colonel Bishop, Admiral Zhao spoke up.
Excuse me, he began, the first time a flag officer had ever apologized for interrupting me. Half the people in the room were nodding when Zhao looked around. They were all thinking the same thing.
I do not see, the Admiral flipped through the briefing packet in front of him, that these Elder weapons you brought have anti-access area denial capability.
They don't, I admitted. A2AD is a fancy term for things like mines that prevent an enemy from entering your territory. In land warfare, anti-access can be provided by equipment like trenches and barbed wire to prevent armored vehicles and infantry from crossing a barrier. What Admiral Zhao meant was that our fancy Elder weapons could not be used to keep Maxulk ships away from Earth. Zhao looked around, one eyebrow raised but displaying less surprise than the moment called for.
Then, when you ordered the Maxulk's task force to leave the solar system...
I was bluffing, I said. That caused a murmur around the room.
You took one hell of a risk.
The Admiral sat back in his chair. He was frowning at me, but he also gave me an almost imperceptible nod. Respect. I had made a gutsy move and it paid off. He respected that. It wasn't only a bluff, I added. The enemy commander almost certainly had to report back to his leadership to brief them and get orders. I can't imagine he had authority to deal with Elder weapons on his own. Heads nodded around the room and people murmured to each other. They were all senior military and government officials. They knew all about the limits of authority. These people had risen through the ranks the hard way by being team players and following orders. They were not reckless Mustangs like me.
Still, Zhao shook his head, that was a substantial risk. Colonel Bishop,
Surely the Maxhawks know the capabilities of our new weapons.
Most likely, yes, I agreed. Certainly, they recognize the exterior configuration and power signatures. A general from Indonesia spoke next.
In your view, what role are the Elder weapons capable of performing?
Sir, I answered, looking straight at him, they are strictly second strike assets. Damn, that provoked a reaction from the assembled audience. Again, the military officers were frowning and nodding to each other, while the civilians were horrified or confused. The generals and admirals knew what I meant, and they were not really surprised by what I said. To provide a little background without getting into nerdy details, second strike is a term used in strategic weapons planning. Until recently, on Earth, strategic weapons were limited to nukes. Basically, a first-strike nuke is a missile delivery system and warhead that are accurate enough to destroy the enemy's nuclear missiles and their silos. The concept of a nuclear first strike is you take out most of the enemy's land-based missiles before they can launch. If the enemy is determined to retaliate using bombers or submarine-launched missiles, their options are limited because your own missiles are no longer vulnerable in their silos. If the enemy escalates the war by hitting your cities, you hit their cities, and everyone dies. You hope the enemy will surrender, rather than lose everything. In my opinion, in my vast strategic planning experience as a ground-pounding infantry soldier, the whole idea of a limited first strike is pure bullshit. People are not emotionless computers, and national leaders are people. Once nukes start flying, there is no pulling back from the brink. The only way to win a nuclear war is not to fight one. And that was the problem with our Elder weapons.
Will someone please explain that to me?
Minister Diaz from Chile asked.
It means, a general from China explained for me, we can only use our Elder weapons to retaliate after aliens have wiped out Earth.
The Chilean woman looked stunned.
Not to protect us?
It is a form of protection, I said. If we die, everyone dies, all across the galaxy.
That is little comfort to the dead,
Diaz scowled at me. Ma'am, I agree.
Then what good is...
The Maxhawks and the Rindaloo. They know their own Elder weapons are also useful only for a second strike. If they hit us, we refuse to reset the timers on the weapons in their territory. Sentinels wake up and... I shrugged. Like I said, everyone dies. Diaz bit her lower lip like she was being extra patient with me.
Perhaps I did not ask the right question. Colonel Bishop, what defenses does Earth have to protect our citizens?
We have Valkyrie and the Flying Dutchman.
Two starships? That is all?
The Kishan and the Dagger are not useful as weapons platforms, I explained. She wasn't letting me off the hook.
Two starships are not an effective defense.
No, it is not. We need a strategic defense satellite network around Earth with sensor fields extending out a light minute or more. We need the capability to manufacture our own warships, and until we have that ability, we need to purchase ships that can be upgraded. We need allies, ma'am.
I think we can all agree to that,
Admiral Zhao muttered loud enough for everyone to hear.
Colonel Bishop, could you continue with your report?
The debriefings went on like that, with one group after another asking the same questions and me giving the same answers. Blessedly, the debrief got cut short when a group of Giraptha ships arrived through the backstop wormhole and waited at the edge of the solar system for permission to approach. UNEF knew I had invited the Beatles to send a diplomatic team to Earth, and while the member governments were upset that I issued the invite without their permission, they also agreed that meeting the Giraptha was a good idea, especially because the Beatles arrived bearing gifts, multi-mission modules for the Flying Dutchman. Basically, the modules were containers that could carry cargo or passengers, depending on how they were configured for mission requirements. We did not suddenly have an extra starship, but the modules did make the good old Dutchman much more useful to us. Anyway, I went to New York to meet the Beatles, as their official delegation landed at JFK Airport. I didn't know any of them. There were a few Giraptha military officers with the diplomats, but we had never met. Mostly, my role was standing around listening to speeches. The only good part of the experience was meeting Hans Chotek again. The two of us got drinks in the bar at his hotel, and we talked about old times. It was actually nice hanging out with him for a while. We had a rough start, but now we respected each other. The next morning, the UN staff hinted that I should leave the negotiations to the experts, and I was relieved to get out of there. My first destination, after meeting the Beatles at UN headquarters in New York, was not making a relatively short flight home to visit my folks. We had chatted by video conference over the secure Skippytel network every night. That was not the same as seeing them, and I promised to get to Maine as soon as possible. That was also a promise to myself, and not only because I was worried about my parents. The fact was, I was homesick. That surprised me. My motivation for signing up for the Army was to get away from my hometown. Now I couldn't wait to get back. Anyway, my first stop was to visit the family of Fal Desai. Chang had already been there. They knew about their daughter's death, of course, from reports sent down from the Dutchman before the crew landed. There was a national day of mourning in India for her and the three other Indian Army soldiers who died at that lonely space station on the day we call Armageddon. They were all heroes in their country, though Fal was understandably the most famous. It simply was not practical for me to visit the families of everyone we lost along the way, and it may seem callous, but I chose the six people I knew best, people I had a personal as well as professional connection with. Rene Giraud's family was next on my list. He had been with us ever since I fooled the original pirates into leaving paradise with me. People, and by people in this case I mean civilians, usually honor the sacrifices made by the armed forces of their country. Still, some people, in the back of their minds, have a subtle feeling that military deaths are somehow less tragic, that because we know the risks when we signed up to serve, military deaths are simply part of the job we get paid for, that a certain number of deaths is expected, even if just from relatively mundane stuff like boats sinking, helicopters crashing, or vehicles rolling over. My feeling is that sentiment is dead wrong. The deaths of people like Fal Desai, who volunteered to risk their lives for others, is more tragic. It's not just the military. I think the same applies to first responders like firefighters, people who put their lives at risk for us, so we don't have to. Okay, now I'm going to get down off my soapbox. That's all I will say about the subject. Meeting Fal's family was awkward. They had time to accept that she was dead. Really, I debated about whether I should meet them at all. Would talking with me bring up painful memories again? Make them relive hearing the awful news? I was not worried they would scream at me and blame me for a death. If that helped them heal, they could yell all they wanted. They couldn't say anything I hadn't already said to myself 1,000 times since Armageddon. Had I taken a foolish risk to capture a set of power boosters? Was there a safer alternative to raiding that space station? Skippy and Chang and Sims and Smythe and I had debated the subject endlessly, and none of us thought of a better option. We raided that isolated station because it seemed like the safest place to obtain the vital components we needed to get Valkyrie fully operational. Since that day, I had not been able to dream up any clever way we could have acquired power boosters with less risk. But to be honest, I had not thought about it a lot. Maybe I just hadn't put in the effort to develop an alternative. Maybe I didn't want to find a safer way to have done it, for fear that all those deaths were for nothing. Chang had cautioned me that while learning from past mistakes is important, it is also important not to obsess about things I can't change. It's not healthy for me, and such obsession makes me a less effective leader. Before meeting Desai's family at their home, we chatted on the phone. They could not have been nicer. They really wanted to see me, to talk about their daughter. The flight was aboard a dropship that was escorted by Indian Air Force fighter jets for the final leg. There were local leaders at the airport. I tried to keep the meet and greet there short. Then I got in a car for a motorcade to meet the Desais. It was unfortunately a huge media circus. Skippy offered to block communications in the area. I declined. The people of India wanted to see me. It was important they see me honoring their lost sister. At the house, blessedly, we had peace and quiet, The police cordoned off the block to keep the media away, and Skippy jammed any attempts to fly camera drones over the house. Like they were when we spoke on the phone, the Desai family could not have been nicer. What they most wanted was to hear me talk about their daughter. So I told stories about her. About how courageous she was, how calm she was under pressure, how she had never boasted about her abilities, but she had been the first human to fly many different types of alien spacecraft. Mostly, I talked about our last mission together. Her last mission. When she was my somewhat reluctant executive officer. Those memories were the most fresh in my mind and the most personal for me. Acting as my XO meant I had spent more time with her and talked more in depth, gotten to know her better, as an officer and a person. "I'm sorry," I said after a very nice dinner. "I wish we could have..."
"Don't."
Her mother reached across the table to put a hand on mine while her other hand clutched her husband's.
"When she was here, between missions, Fal often told us that serving with the Merry Band of Pirates was the greatest honor of her life. She volunteered for her last mission because she admired you."
On the flight out, I was quiet. Quiet enough that Skippy pinged my earpiece. "Are you okay, Joe?"
"Me?"
"Yeah, I was just thinking about how much we've lost along the way. Fal made the ultimate sacrifice, yes.
She did.
It's not just that. Everyone in the military makes sacrifices, not just people who are killed or wounded. Putting yourself in harm's way is not the only type of sacrifice. Just being deployed and away from your family, that's a sacrifice. Soldiers can get assigned to live in substandard housing where mold is growing on the walls. You get posted to some shithole base stateside where there is nothing to do off base and your family hates being there. You have to fill out forms online, but the computer the Army gave you doesn't have the certs needed to access the form. You were ready to knock off work at 1600 on the Friday of a holiday weekend, but the company suddenly needs to conduct an inventory that day, even though battalion knew about the request 3 weeks ago. So, you're there until midnight, and the inventory report gets submitted. Then battalion won't look at it until Wednesday because they took a 3-day weekend.
Listen, Skippy, yes, we have lost people along the way. Those people did make the ultimate sacrifice. Every one of the Merry Band of Pirates made sacrifices. We got stuck for months inside a spaceship where you can't even look out a window, and you see the same people, and eat in the same galley, and use the same gym equipment every day. If we're lucky, we get some excitement because someone is shooting at us. The crew are away from their families and friends, sometimes not knowing if we will ever get home. That is a sacrifice, too. Whether you are a ranger or a forklift operator, you put up with shit that civilians don't have to deal with. He didn't say anything right away. Then, why do you do it?
I wish I could say it's because someone has to. That's part of it, sure, but we do it for each other. The guy next to you is getting the job done, and you don't want to let him down.
Hey, sorry to dump this on you, buddy.
No problem, Joe. It sounds like this is something you need to talk about, and I know you don't have many people you can talk with. I'm here. Anytime.
But... I expected him to say something snarky.
No buts. I'm for real, homeboy.
He held out a tiny holographic fist, and I bumped it. We talked for a while, the two of us alone in the rear of the dropship's cabin, while we flew to France, where I was scheduled to attend a ceremony for René Giraud. He was right. I had a lot of stuff I needed to talk about. Maybe someday I could talk with Margaret, but she was busy elsewhere, and Skippy was with me right then. It helped.
"I don't understand," my father said to me as he rubbed my mother's shoulders. We were sitting at the table in their kitchen. A remodeling project was in progress. Some of the cabinets were gone and there were bare studs exposed on the wall with new bats of insulation in place. It looked like someone, probably my father, had started removing the countertop on the wrong side of the stove, then stopped and set the counter back in place, partially cracked.
There were sheets of clear plastic taped up to keep the sawdust contained, but the plastic had a fine coating of regular household dust and pollen that drifted in through the window screens. Some of the blue tape was peeled away like it had dried out and couldn't stick anymore. The overall impression I got from looking around was a project that had stopped abruptly. They had money problems, I knew that. My army pay went to them as I had directed. My intention had been to help my parents through hard times. Even if the economy crashed, the U.S. Army would continue to send out paychecks. The checks might be delayed, and my parents might be surprised by a notice that, through no fault of my own, I had mistakenly been overpaid for the past 16 months, so my next two paychecks would be zero. But overall, they would have a steady income if they needed it. Several times I had urged them to use the money that was piling up in their bank account, explaining that the government was actually getting a good deal from my service. While I was away, I was not consuming meals on base, was not using military healthcare facilities or TRICARE, was really not costing the taxpayers anything other than, you know, fear and anxiety. But of course, my parents had not touched a dime of my money, even when they needed it. Both my father and mother had lost their jobs. The big cogeneration plant in Millicoddock had closed, throwing my father out of work. He looked for a job farther south, though the drive to Bangor would be a killer. The plan was for him to come home on weekends. But around that time, the Flying Dutchman was officially declared overdue to return from our survey trip to find a beta site, and there was widespread panic around the world. The cover story of the Dutchman being flown by our buddies the Theranin broke down completely, and suddenly the name Joe Bishop became infamous. My father was turned away from every place he contacted about work and was basically told not to bother applying. At the same time, my mother's employer had to let her go. So many news people and protesters harassed her at work that the place had to shut down. They had federal protection at first. That trailed off after a while, as town residents got tired of roadblocks and checkpoints and helicopters flying around at night just to protect two not very popular citizens. Joe Bishop had gone from local hero to someone the town wanted to forget about. When the Barney Ice Cream Truck Memorial in the town square was firebombed one night, that was the last straw. My parents retreated to live in my Uncle Edgar's old fishing shack on Massacutt Lake. Hardly anyone lived there, and the only road in was a dirt track, so the state police could position a patrol car there to keep out unwanted guests. Not that many protesters bothered to make the trip so far into the wilderness anyway. Other than black flies and mosquitoes and loneliness, it wasn't a bad place to be, until the winter. What mattered now was they were back home. The name Joe Bishop was not exactly celebrated, but there were fewer wackadoodle nuts who cared enough to bother my parents. They had driven down to their house while I was being debriefed at Fort Carson, and this time they had a security team of military police from the 10th Mountain, my old unit. When I heard that, I kind of got choked up with emotion. At some point, I needed to stop at Fort Drum to thank them properly. The money was not an issue. I fixed that by asking Skippy to put my parents on his payroll as consultants or some bullshit like that. The idea upset my parents and made me uneasy. Hopefully it would be temporary. Skippy, of course, didn't care about such a small amount of money, and I didn't ask about the source of the funds. "Understand what, Dad?" I asked in response. "It's over, isn't it? The war?" He squeezed my mother's shoulder as he spoke. "Our part in the war?" "No." I rolled in my hand the still-cold can of Lester Cornut's Paradise Pale Ale. Dave had given me a case, and I brought 2 4-packs to my folks. My father enjoyed a good beer. He had sipped from his can and declared it delicious. I noted the can had sat untouched since the first sip. Truthfully, I didn't much feel like drinking either. The conversation was too depressing to encourage friendly drinking. My parents had been telling me how they were hounded by the media and protesters, received death threats, and finally been chased out of their home. My sister and a new husband had been forced to leave Boston for southern New Hampshire. They both worked mostly from home, but her husband had to go into the office in the I-49 tech corridor, and sometimes he found a reporter or concerned citizen waiting for him in the parking lot. My sister was understandably scared. My parents were frightened for her, and none of them blamed me. Yet it was my fault, and I wanted to fix it. The problem was, I couldn't fix everything.
Not exactly, I said, and used my favorite delaying technique of taking a drink. That time it was beer instead of coffee.
Joseph, we have nukes now. Elder weapons.
My father looked at me, pleading.
Skippy told us about them. Those weapons can tear stars apart.
They can. That's all they can do. Dad? Mom, we are safe from extinction. Anything beyond that? I put my hands on the table. Listen, Dad, imagine you have a gun that could kill the enemy, but pulling the trigger would kill you also. The enemy starts poking you with a stick, keeps poking you over and over until you're bleeding. You're bleeding, and it hurts, but you're alive.
At some point, my father's jaw was clenched. I would pull the trigger on the son of a bitch.
What if firing the gun also killed Mom? And everyone you knew.
Shit, he sighed.
I knew he was upset because he snatched up the beer and downed half of it in one gulp.
But you have Valkyrie now.
Yeah, one ship. It can't be everywhere. Eventually, soon, Valkyrie will need heavy maintenance. We'll need to fly somewhere and strip the ship down to rebuild it. That can't happen here. The enemy might be watching.
We do have a plan, I lied.
It wasn't quite a lie. UNEF was considering a plan, or many possible plans. Deciding which plan to implement and getting every country's buy-in and support was the trick. Plus, you know, making the plan work. As the old saying goes, the enemy also makes plans. Damn them.
Joseph, my mother put her hand on mine. Let's talk about something else. Not about war. There's been too much of that.
Okay, Mom. I set the beer down. That would be great. My father also looked relieved.
Skippy hinted, my mother looked straight at me, that there might be a girl.
Shit. I wanted to strangle that sneaky little beer can.
Maybe. We're seeing where things are going.
Margaret was with her parents that same day. We had both agreed not to mention our relationship yet. I wanted to protect her until we had more time together and decided whether we wanted to move to the next stage in our relationship. No, I do not mean the Pottery Barn stage. I mean the telling our parents about us stage. Now, Skippy had short-circuited everything.
There might be a girl, Mom. It's a new thing. Can we talk about it later?
My mother looked a bit disappointed and hurt. She also knew not to push me. I would tell her about Margaret, once I knew what to tell her. Once I knew what was going on with our relationship. In my parents' kitchen, I was making an afternoon snack. My father and I had just come back from fishing, which involved a whole lot of paddling a canoe across a lake into a gusty wind, and not a lot of catching fish, because fish are stupid. My arms were tired, and I was hungry. We had brought meatloaf sandwiches for lunch, but a wave slapped me in the face and made me drop most of my sandwich into the lake. Of course, a couple big bass came up to eat the floating sandwich while ignoring the bait on the hook. The only time I even thought a fish was nibbling on the bait was when the hook got caught on weeds. So we came back with zero fish. Stupid fish. It didn't matter. The point of fishing was to drink beer and spend time with my father. When we got back, my father went to the garage to put away the fishing gear while I went to the house for a snack. Searching the pantry, I found a can of brown bread and jars of peanut butter and fluff. The bread popped out of the can, I sliced it, and put it in the toaster. When it was warm and slightly crispy, I slathered peanut butter on one piece and fluff on the other.
Mmm!
The taste made me roll my eyes. I mean that in a good way.
Joe, Skippy said through the phone in my pocket. How can you eat that? Fluff is just pure sugar.
It is pure deliciousness, I retorted. It's a superfood, Skippy.
Super? Maybe you need to look up the definition of that term. A superfood is, yeah, antioxidants, blah, blah, blah.
Listen, Skippy, when you eat stuff like kale or acai berries or whatever, your body is like, being healthy is not worth it if I have to eat this crap. But when you eat a fluffernutter, your body says, now I have something to live for.
So fluff is a superfood, like pizza or tacos.
pizza and tacos. Would you want to live if you couldn't eat pizza or tacos? I can't eat anything, you moron. Oh, sorry. You don't know what you're missing. Like heartburn and cholesterol? Goodbye, Skippy. Hey, buddy, I forgot to ask, I said to Skippy that night. How is your opera coming along? That was a blatant lie. I had not forgotten to ask him. I had avoided that subject as long as I felt possible. It was better for me to mention the opera and get credit for pretending to care than for him to pout and get pissed off at me for neglecting one of his great passions. Asking Skippy about his musical compositions was like poking a hornet's nest with a stick. You need a plan to get away as quickly as possible. My plan was to pretend I just remembered an important UNEF meeting when I got to the point where I just couldn't stand listening to him blabber on and on any longer.
Opera? Oh, which one?
Shit. That I had forgotten. He had more than one opera in progress. What the hell were they about? There was one about the 1932 Manhattan phone book and... the Homefront one, I guessed. Had he stopped work on that? Crap, I should have paid more attention. Oh, that! Yeah, I'd put that aside for the moment. Actually, all of my operatic work is presently on hold. Yes, I understand that is a tragic loss to the artistic community and that millions of monkeys are crying out to hear my unique vision. Somehow, I mumbled. We will manage to persevere. I asked, anxious to change the subject before he got inspired or whatever and decided to resurrect his crappy music. What are you working on now?
Movie soundtracks, Joe.
Movie, soundtracks? What?
Oh, right. Please spare me your pretentious, condescending attitude. Oh, sure, you think that real composers, real artists, do not lower themselves to work on commercial projects. Well, I have news for you, Mr. Snobby Snob.
Sorry, I mumbled, though I did not give a shit what composers did or didn't do.
The true groundbreaking compositions are being done in soundtracks now, Joe. A great soundtrack can make a mediocre film something special. Without an evocative score, the best script and performances simply fall flat. You should think about that the next time you disparage any composer who chooses to work in an alternative medium.
Geez, Skippy, all I did was ask a question.
Hm, he sniffed. It was the way you asked it.
There was absolutely no point to arguing with him, so I dropped it. What movie are you writing the soundtrack for?
I'm starting with the one about me, of course.
A movie about you? When did I wrote a script? Several versions of scripts, actually. And there is great interest in Hollywood. Ugh, I've been so busy getting this project off the ground.
Wow.
For once, I was glad that I asked Skippy about one of his side projects. You are making a movie about us? The Merry Band of Pirates? Who will play me?
Gosh, well, who could play such a part, Joe? That is asking a lot for any actor. Really, it's not fair. Maybe we should just...
You little shithead, I gasped with sudden understanding.
You cut me out of your freaking movie?
Hey, the story is about me, Joe. My sidekick is not sidekick.
That's what you think I...
Joe, listen, it may be tough to hear, but your story would simply not be believable to the audience.
It doesn't have to be believable. Hell, I can barely believe it, but it did happen.
You know that, and I know that. Or you know the bullshit fantasy version you've created in your own head, but the public has seen you being interviewed. They know you are a doofus. No way will they buy a script where you are the hero.
So your solution is to write me out of the story?
No, of course not, he scoffed, then immediately backtracked. Not entirely. The producers want to replace your part with a cute little monkey named Joe. Not an actual monkey, of course. They are impossible to work with. We'll do motion capture and CGI in the monkey during post-production.
Wait, what producers? Someone is actually making a movie about you?
I am considering multiple offers, Joe. I haven't signed any deal yet.
I cannot believe you wrote me out of the script.
Don't take it personally. Hollywood is all about money, Joe. You are a controversial person, whereas I am universally loved and admired. I made a gagging sound. Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Sorry, Joe. Everyone I talked to so far emphasized that we need to move quickly and get the movie out before, you know.
Before what? Well, this is just awkward.
Before what?
Before you, you know, you screw up again and cause a major disaster. Once that inevitably happens, somehow I will get the blame and no one will want to watch a movie about me. That is totally unfair, but you don't hear me whining about it. Maybe you should take a lesson from that.
Oh my God. You just assume I'm gonna screw up big time?
You treasonous little shithead.
Hey, it's not my fault. I'm just projecting forward based on your history. Besides, we both know that the universe hates you. Do you seriously think the universe saw that you got a stash of elder weapons and said, "Well, that darn Joey beat me for sure. Time to give up." No way, Jose. The universe can't wait to show you who is boss, and it ain't Joe Bishop.
Crap. Am I right?
Damn it, I sighed. I actually cannot argue with you about that.
Woohoo! Can I get an amen?
No, you can't get an amen. What the hell is wrong with you? You know what? Go make your stupid movie. See if I care.
Cool!
To be clear, you don't care, right?
Go away, Skippy.
Being at my parents' house was great. Really great. Really. It was great. Shit. Okay, being with my folks again was great. I just wasn't able to relax at all. My phone would have rung nonstop if Skippy had not intercepted most of the calls, and most of the time I had to take a call, it was for people asking stupid things I couldn't give them, like answers about...
Hidey-ho there, filthy monkeys, tis I!
Skippy the Magnificent.
I will pause to let you compose yourselves from the shock that I would waste my precious time talking to you. Ready? I know, you still can't believe it. Suck it up and pay attention, because I'm not going to repeat myself. Okay, so, the reason I need to honor you with my presence is because, as usual, Joe is telling the story all wrong, so ignore his blah blah blah, and I'll give you the truth. What is unusual is this time. He is not telling you some bullshit to make himself look like a hero. This time, Joe is pretending everything is fine and not relating most of the awful shit he went through. The debriefing at Fort Carson was not easy, like he said. It was brutal and went on forever. The interrogation only stopped because I crashed the base computer network and the electrical grid and pretty much everything in a 10-mile radius that operated on electricity. Listen, Joe did this to himself, so I only have a limited amount of sympathy for him. The politicians who treat Joe like shit? He kind of asked for it. When we first came to Earth and kicked ass, freeing your miserable mudball of a planet from the Kristang, every political leader who knew the truth wanted to be Joe's best friend. Then, we came back after our Spec Ops mission, having saved the world a second time, and Joe was bragging about it like he expected a commendation. The actual reaction from UNEF leadership was, "WTF, you told us Earth was safe the first time." Since then, every time the merry band of pirates does something worth celebrating, Joe has to hold up his hand and say, we shmaybe have a problem. Again. Many people have been burned by praising Joe, only to watch their credibility and careers go down in flames when Joe inevitably announces he failed to consider long-term consequences and we are all doomed. Again. So, I have sympathy for the guy. To a point. He is my buddy, and part of being a friend is recognizing that your friend is a short-sighted, reckless knucklehead. He is also my friend, and while he usually tells the story all wrong, part of the time he is not giving himself enough credit. Joe talks a lot about playing video games, and he does that sometimes, not often. He also works hard. When he's not reading or writing reports, he's exercising in the gym, or keeping his skills current in a flight simulator, or taking training to operate one of the stations on the bridge. Or he is reading about our enemies, trying to understand their history, the capabilities and characteristics of their ships and weapons, their typical strategies and tactics, so we might have an advantage when we encounter them in combat. Yes, he is a dumbass. But no more than the typical monkey. Anyway, Joe seriously needed a break. And Margaret also seriously needed a break, and I was hoping that a week of exposure to 100% pure grade A Joe Bishop would make her realize what a horrible mistake she was making.
I cleared their calendars and booked them on a vacation in the South Pacific where they would have a chance for some privacy.